Interview with Bob Pease, J2 Engine.
So I'll turn this on. And one of these things, in the design of the J2, I get the impression that it was designed to be tested at altitude and sea level, or something like that. But it, no, designed to be tested at sea level, although it was going to be fired, you know, very high. Was this a particular problem? Was it the first engine to be designed that way, at least in the liquid hydrogen technology class?
No, let me say that there was a particular desire to be able to fire the complete engine, including the bell nozzle, which was a 27.5:1 area ratio nozzle, under the sea level test stand conditions. The reason for doing this, of course, was number one, to ensure that we had the might say the ability to fire the engine in a more with more ease, which you can do in a sea level environment than if you have to do it in an altitude chamber. So the test frequency question was important. So the engine bell nozzle was designed to flow full at the sea level test conditions. And this was important in order to get the proper heat fluxes and so forth into the chamber, which, in other words, the chamber was being cooled by hydrogen. The hydrogen, of course, picks up heat as it goes up through the wall and comes into the injector. So trying to get as near as possible the proper heat transfer conditions on the chamber under sea level firing. So another thing involved was the fact that if the nozzle didn't flow full, not only did it affect the heat transfer to the thrust chamber wall, it would make it difficult to recording.
Okay, we're on again. Yeah.
Oh, did you miss all that, or shall I go over?
Why don't you just recapitulate? I think I moved this over here because of the sometimes we get a lot of overtone noise from air conditioning equipment.
All right. Well, I think I can shorten that down.
Okay.
I think if I understand your question, you're saying that the basic question you asked was in fact the engine, some reason for having the engine designed to both be fired at sea level and at altitude, and was this a first in the engine business? Okay. So to recapitulate, yes, there was a reason for having the engine be able to fire both at sea level and altitude, and the reason to have it fire at sea level is in order to obtain more easily the testing, numbers of tests, and so forth, and to do it under an easier test environment than you have to when you're playing with the diffusers and altitude equipment. That facilitates your development effort that way. So because of this, the engine was designed to give as near possible the proper performance on the sea level test by having the nozzle flow full. When the nozzle flows full, if it doesn't flow full, you have problems in measuring the thrust, and you also have a difference in heat transfer to the thrust chamber wall. All right, as it turned out, the engine, there were still differences in the way the engine performed at sea level and the way it performed under altitude test. There were some changes in the engine power balance due to the difference in pressure ratio between sea level and altitude across the turbine areas. And there was also some difference in the heat transferred to the thrust chamber wall simply by the fact that under the altitude conditions, you had you had, let's say, a very reduced atmospheric situation, and you weren't even transferring atmospheric heat into the thrust chamber wall. So there were some differences both in those two areas. However, I don't know if I'm answering your question completely on this. Was this a first? I think it was a first from the standpoint of trying to get a nozzle of a higher expansion ratio to flow full at sea level. And the nozzle was a special contour, which was designed in order to facilitate this. And that part of it was a first. I believe on previous programs, such as the RL-10, we had to use some type of diffuser system if we were going to flow the full, the complete nozzle, the complete engine nozzle. So I don't know, was that...
That answers the question, I think. I'll have to do some research on it, too. I'm going to try and find out some more things. Maybe I can pick up the phone sometime. He's calling back.
Fine.
Now, they did use vacuum diffuser equipment in the J2 development studies.
Yes, they did.
Was there a difference, say, in the diffuser equipment that Rocketdyne installed there and what was used at Tullahoma?
Yes.
Why was there, how did the difference occur and what was the intent? And why do some out testing at Susanna and why do some at Tullahoma?
Well, what amounts to is this, that when the program was started, it was recognized that there still had to be an altitude system type test to verify the engine behavior under altitude. Mm-hmm. That even though the engine was designed such that it could be tested at sea level, it would still recognize there would be some differences in the when testing in altitude environment. So from a very beginning program outset, the steam-operated diffuser was planned at San Susana to evaluate the engine under vacuum operating conditions. Now the steam-operated diffuser operated in such a manner as that steam was supplied during the engine start transient, which pulled the capsule pressure down to something in the neighborhood of 80, around 80,000 feet. Then when the engine started, the diffuser would operate in a manner, it would be activated by the exhaust gases of the nozzle in order then to maintain the capsule vacuum pressure under main stage operating conditions. And then when the engine shut down, the steam would come on again to try to maintain the altitude conditions. Mm-hmm. Well, when this system was actually put into operation, it was discovered that the steam system was unable to maintain the 80,000 foot altitude during the start transient. And part of the reason for this was the fact that when the diffuser and steam system were designed, they didn't anticipate the amount of hydrogen fuel lead that was going to be produced by the engine.
Hmm.
And hydrogen being densities and so forth, this fuel lead very quickly saturated the altitude producing capabilities of the steam system such that the altitude would drop down to less than 20,000 feet during the engine start.
And if you're shooting for 80, that's not a very good condition.
Right. And not only that, they also found that there was considerable steam blowback and turbulence that came back and got into the nozzle area, which also fouled up some of the heat transfer inputs to the chamber and one thing or another, so that between the pressure ratio across the oxidizer turbine and the steam blowback, it was felt that our altitude simulation was less than optimum.
Hmm.
So from that standpoint, we then made an investigation to find out if the Tullahoma facility would be available in order to run some additional series of altitude tests. fact, along with this investigation, we also investigated constructing another altitude facility at Santa Susana, which would have been operated by another type of steam system, one which would have kept the altitudes up in the neighborhood of 90 to 100,000 feet at all times. And Rocketdyne had successfully demonstrated what they called a hyperflow steam system using an H1 engine, basically an H1 engine,
mm-hmm.
to generate steam.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having a steam accumulator, which had limited capacities, they were going to fire essentially a rocket engine with water injection, which would have generated very large steam capacities instantaneously upon demand for keeping the altitude up. That system looked very good and would have cost us, however, several million dollars to put that in at Santa Susana. And so in the process of looking at all this, it became apparent that it would be more cost effective to activate the Tullahoma stand, the J4 cell at Tullahoma, for this purpose. So that's how the Tullahoma program came into being. And once we got into the J4 cell, we did find that we did learn some further knowledge as to the engine starting characteristics that wasn't apparent at the testing at Santa Susana, either under the altitude or the sea level testing.
So you had to do a little redesign?
Yeah, it did cause some redesign, but it was not of a major nature, mainly orificing and balancing of the engine start, primarily. And the Tullahoma conditions on the heat transfer to the thrust chamber and so forth were further verified as being accurate, but this is just a side note. When they looked at the flight data, they found that the flight data substantiated our performance results at Tullahoma. So Tullahoma was a pretty good facility from that standpoint. One thing that Tullahoma didn't do, or any of the testing didn't do, was it did not find what we call the ASI problem on 502.
All right, can you, while I get another card down here, can you go into that a little bit?
Sure.
Yeah, we're still running. I'm just kidding.
Okay.
Yeah.
You might have already got some history on this, but
a little bit. But like
you may have known, we did fail an ASI line in the S2 stage and also in the S4B stage on flight 502, and the ASI fuel line that was later discovered to be a fatigue failure of the line caused by flow vibration.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, flow induced vibration. Now, turns out that this was not discovered under sea level testing or even under altitude conditions of the Tullahoma stand because, well, number one, under sea level conditions, there's a condensation of air that gets in between the bellows section. This does two things. Number one, it's maybe a lesser effect of it, but it does provide some damping of the bellows. Secondly, it does affect the heat transfer boundary layer conditions on the inside of the flow path. So when Rocketdyne ran laboratory tests and took photographs, movie photographs, and made other flow dynamic studies, they found out that the heating effect of the line actually changed the flow vibration flow induced vibration characteristics. But I'm not a flow vibration expert, so I'm trying to explain it.
Neither am I.
Simple terms, as I understand it. In other words, apparently it changed the boundary layer conditions on the inside of the line so that the flow pattern wasn't the same.
Mm-hmm.
And now, So that is it. Now, why didn't this happen at Tullahoma? Well, there's a good an altitude condition we were obtaining, 100,000 feet or so. There's still enough nitrogen present in the cell to, and this is a theory is presumed on, to at least the calculations that have been made, that to provide the same effect.
Okay, I didn't understand that then. So it was nitrogen still existing in the cell to create that kind of frost buildup and have the same damping effect.
Well, it was both nitrogen and water, and I say nitrogen because I believe in Rocketdyne's testing, they proved that frost alone would not prevent the failure. That it really, really had to be the air condensation. In other words, if it were packed with ice, it's one thing, but a minor frost buildup, I think alone was not considered sufficient prevent the failure. So the way I understand it now is that I believe there was enough nitrogen condensation within the cell to have done this. Now, I guess one way of, maybe another way of tackling the problem is that I don't really know if this is a feasible way, if nitrogen could have been substituted for some other gas, such as a helium purge. And the reason I don't like helium is because the lighter the gas is, the harder it is to pump it out.
But isn't that the way they finally got the fix on it, though? They put it in a helium tank or something?
Yes, as a matter of fact, in the testing at Santa Susana, they tested with a helium environment, a vacuum environment, with the air environment, and they found out that it would fail under the helium environment because the helium wouldn't condense.
Mm-hmm.
That it would fail under the vacuum environment, the hard vacuum environment,
yeah.
You know, in a test capsule, you know, small test capsule, where they can pump it down quite a bit higher altitude than Tullahoma.
Yeah.
And so that's how they finally pinpointed it, was by isolating these different environments. So, it's quite an interesting investigation, I think to many of us it said that there are always certain problems that one cannot predict in advance, and all the analytical techniques cannot even plan for. Well, now that we know about this one, we always plan for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, so therefore, I'm sure that in the Space Shuttle Main Engine program or other future programs, we will still continue to plan altitude type testing. Although in this particular case in J2, it didn't find this problem.
You were out at Rocket. Let's see. Were you the MSFC representative out there?
I was the resident manager for the J2.
Okay. Do you remember very much about the story on the injector phase and the use of Rigimesh? Were you involved in that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Could you give me a little bit
what
more?
What would you like to know about it?
Well, it's my understanding that it was the Paul Corporation that came up with the Rigimesh stuff in New York. And that they got this out of the Atomic Energy Commission program that used it for filtering gases or something.
Yes, I believe that's correct. I know the material was produced for purposes such of that nature, and I guess it also had been used on the RL-10 program.
Mm-hmm. But so I guess my question is this: now you've got the you had some problems with the injector, I guess, well, normal development problems. But who or where does the decision come to get into Rigimesh? Does Marshall say that?
I just happened to be intimately involved in that one.
Mm-hmm.
That we started the J2 program. Rocketdyne had proposed a copper ring type injector, which was typical of most previous Rocketdyne designs, with the orifice, you know, various orifice holes drilled at various angles in the copper. The Rigimesh had been used successfully on the RL-10 program and had had been, in fact, I guess, introduced to the RL-10 program by Lewis people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before that, where they got it from, I think, what you say is right, Atomic Energy Commission may have used it for filtering devices one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
But it was used in the RL-10 program as a ejector plate medium in order to allow the hydrogen to filter through and partially cool the face by that means.
Mm-hmm.
And so people were concerned at that time about the problem of cooling the face and felt that we might have some, Lewis people felt we might have some problems with the copper. And so in the early part of the J2 program, got back to the initial discussions on getting into the program, it was suggested to Rocketdyne by NASA that, that they include in the development program an alternate design of a rigid mesh face type injector, and that they evaluate both the copper design which they proposed and this alternate rigid mesh injector, and then sometime downstream there would be a decision made as to which one was best.
In this case, the impetus came from NASA.
Right.
To Rocketdyne.
Right, and this is part of NASA's transfer of technology, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
We were aware of the material. We were aware that it had been used in other rocket engine programs, and we felt that Rocketdyne ought to look at it also.
Mm-hmm.
So after, I don't remember the exact time frame, but I think it's within probably about the first 6 to 9 months. Early injector testing. They did test several copper versions and several rigid mesh versions, and in the overall assessment, Rocketdyne came to the conclusion, and NASA agreed, that the rigid mesh performed not only performance-wise better in terms of the particular concentric post orifices where the hydrogen came out around each post, each LOX oxidizer post in the rigid mesh face. So the design performed well from a ISP standpoint,
mm-hmm.
and it performed well from a cooling standpoint. There was no problem with burning, and we did have some problems with the copper in the injector on burning the rings and lands and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember one that where we had green flame coming out the chamber during one test. But I'm sure they could have solved the copper problem. I'm sure they could have solved the cooling problem. But it just turned out that
mm-hmm.
in that evaluation, the rigid mesh was best.
Well, this is an interesting factor, a feature, it seems to me, of the Saturn or NASA programs in general, you know, that you do. Here is Marshall operating, cooperating with Lewis and with the contractor. And it's mm-hmm. the kind of technology of one center, in this case Lewis, that comes through Marshall and into the Rocketdyne facility, that there's this interchange interface.
Well, I remember that particular one because I had worked with the Lewis people up on the technical committee of the source evaluation for the J2, and in that capacity I got familiar with those people and that particular subject, and so I was a part of convincing Rocketdyne that we should do this.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me. Now, again, there's a question I wanted to ask, kind of a specific one. Rocketdyne got the contract and started work to put together an experimental engine, and later fired an experimental engine. Now, where the hell do you get an experimental engine? Do you just go out in the shop and start hand working an injector face? Put together a few tubes. I mean, how do you
You first have to design it.
Yeah. Well, what I'm getting at, there's no manufacturing lines set up yet, really. The first test engine really is a handmade product. Is it accurate to say that?
No. No, it isn't. On the J2, Rocketdyne designed a J2 engine as they envisioned it.
They used a computer model. I know they used a lot of computer stuff.
That's true.
Configuration.
They took their analysis and their size, the ducts, tubes, and so forth for the proper heat, thrust chamber size for the proper heat transfer and all
mm-hmm.
that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
In other other words, they designed the engine from a dimensional standpoint based on all their analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went out and released material, or released orders for material, which is not just raw material, but vendors to make certain basic castings and forgings and so forth, and which would and even some components which they purchased from vendors, which was either modification off the shelf items like small valves and things of that sort, or they actually ordered components from certain vendors to their own specifications. So this material comes in house, it's machined to the drawings, it's checked out to the specifications, and they put an engine together. Now they call this an experimental engine. I believe the first one was essentially called an experimental engine because they had had very little, if any, experience with the major components. And one exception was the hydrogen turbopump, which was basically a modification of one that they had already built and run for the Atomic Energy Commission on the rover program.
Mm-hmm.
So we were starting with a turbopump, off-the-shelf turbopump, which was modified
mm-hmm.
somewhat for the J2 application.
Mm-hmm.
The oxidizer pumps were not too unsimilar from the previous engine programs like the H1 and the Atlas and other LOX RP engines. So the oxidizer pumps were quite similar in design to what they had used before, and with some modifications such that in J2 they used separate pumps rather than two pumps run by a gearbox. So each pump had its own turbine. That was a new innovation from previous engines, but so it is not just a handmade type of thing. It's actually analyzed, designed, hardware is released, built, and so forth. And not only that, they didn't just release one set of hardware. They were releasing groups of hardware, and I think they released maybe four or five engines worth of hardware, probably even the initial release. Then from the first engine firing, the experimental engine, they found out some things in which they went back and made some corrections to the hardware that was already in the pipeline. In other words, like they might have to, well, I can't think of a specific example that occurred on the J2, but I think of one thing that happened, our famous 27.5-to-1 thrust chamber, which flows full at sea level, developed a phenomenon which they hadn't predicted, and that's called side loads. During the start transient, a very eccentric load develops in the chamber, forcing the chamber over to one side. So some of the first engines they ran, they actually physically distorted the chamber, distorted the actuator systems and things trying to hold the chamber in place, engine in place.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to quick come up with what they call a horse collar, which was a device that came in and grabbed the chamber at the throat and would hold the engine stable, or hold take the loads during the start, and once it was running, then the thing would drop away so the engine would be gimbaled. But that was not predicted, and that's an example of a kind of a modification you find out you have to make.
Were they able to work out the side load problem later on and get rid of that horse collar thing? That stayed in the whole program?
Yes, it did. And the S2 stage and ground firing used devices to hold the chambers in place.
And the S4B then also has the same thing on it?
During ground firing.
During ground firing.
And that's ground equipment.
Okay, it's not flight hardware.
No, the side loads don't exist in flight because of the vacuum condition.
Well, okay, so it's
a sea level phenomenon only.